Thunder down one, 3 tenths left. Caruso giving the ball. Here we go. Looking, holding. Lobs. Deflected by Turner. It's over. The Indiana Pacers steal game one of the NBA Finals, leading for only the final 3 tenths of a second and winning 111-110 on the Halliburton mid-range jumper.
Live from the Findlay Toyota ESPN Las Vegas studios, this is the Press Box with Graney and Bischoff on ESPN Las Vegas.
Adam Candy is in today for Ed, who is at his son's wedding. Ed is out through Monday, so you get today and another day of Adam Candy to start next week, which will be after Game 2 of the NBA Finals. But you heard the end there of Game 1 as the Pacers stole it from the Thunder and have a 1-0 lead in the NBA Finals. But Adam, I got to ask you about Dwayne Wade here for a second. I sent you a video, and for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's on Twitter, of Dwayne Wade reacting to the end of the game. And I don't care too much about what Dwayne Wade has to say or how he reacts to it. Adam, I'm a little more curious. Where is Dwayne Wade watching this game at? Because he appears to be in an office, and he appears to be hunched over an office chair watching on, like, an iPad. I think we might have lost Adam. I don't know.
You lost me momentarily, okay. But it's only because I had to try to figure out what tiny little office with a weird bookshelf Dwayne Wade was watching this game from. What exactly is, and why does he have a lamp right over his head?
It's such a weird setup. And you know what my favorite part of all of it is? If you look at this in the background, there's like a, you know, it looks like it's just a standard IKEA bookcase, bookshelf in the background.
Oh,
there.
Yeah, look at that.
On the top of this just standard normal bookcase are the Larry O'Brien trophies. Like he's got, hey, look, all of my accomplishments. They're not in a case anywhere. They're not like displayed. He's like in an office tucked away in some home, and there's just, oh, yeah, I won the NBA Finals a couple of times. Look at those up there.
Also, doesn't it appear that like that weird bookshelf is just in front of a picture? Like too much has been put into this room. And why do you think the trophies are all the way at the top like that? Do you think he's trying to hide them from his children? Like no, don't touch the Larry O'Briens. You can't reach him up there.
Maybe he had to take away from his kids. Yeah, you say you're grounded. No Larry O'Brien for you. So yeah, Dwayne Wade probably watched the game in a weirder, worse setup than you did last night, than basically anybody who watches sports did last night, because he was hunched over an iPad or something watching the game. Now, Pacers win game one of the NBA Finals. We talked about yesterday how throughout the postseason, Indiana defensively, Giannis went off against them, Donovan Mitchell went off against them. They were kind of in those two series like, all right, let this guy beat us and see if anybody else, or not let anybody else really do anything. The Knicks did get Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns going, so it wasn't truly like a one-man show for New York. But overall, the Pacers have been kind of okay if the number one player gets his shots and gets going. And last night, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander scored 38 points. He did need 30 shots to do that. But the big number that stuck out to me is that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander had 3 assists last night, and it's the lowest he has had in any game this postseason. In the conference final, he averaged 8 assists per game, and you look at Jalen Williams, their second option, he took 19 shots last night, which is a big number, but scored just 17 points, made just 6 of those shots. And Chet Holmgren only attempted 9 shots, only made 2. Was 2 of 6 in the restricted area. That guy's got arms that can reach the ceiling and was only 2 of 6 in the restricted area. Did you feel like Indiana did a good job of making this the SGA show, or Chet Holmgren's and Jalen Williams just played poorly and they will figure that out? It wasn't really about Indiana.
I think it was probably more about them just not having great nights and this being what you have to put up with a young team, right? SGA is a superstar. There's no question about who he is, and you know you're going to be able to rely on him night in and night out. But this isn't the first time we've seen this sort of disappearing act from Chet Holmgren in particular, and I'm not mad at him for that. I mean, this guy missed a large chunk of the season after, and we talked about this earlier this week, fracturing his butt. Like, he's had a lot to deal with this year. But if he goes and puts up a 2-for-9, 6.6 rebounds, no assists, and one block, you kind of have to live with it, right? Like, Jalen Williams went 6-of-19. He has been very up and down in these playoffs. You just have to live with it because these guys are young and they are mercurial. You might get Chet from the closeout game against the Timberwolves and you get 22 to go with 7 rebounds and 3 blocks. Or you might get him from game 3 where he goes for 10-5. So Oklahoma City has enough options that I think long term in this series they'll be fine. But it does leave the door open for Indiana when you have the 3 best offensive options on this team not perform.
Jalen Williams through this postseason has had shooting performances of 5 of 20, 2 of 13, 3 of 16, 3 of 9, and now a 6 of 19 game against Indiana. He's also had incredible games in between there. He's got multiple 30-point games in this postseason run. He's had multiple games or a ton of games where he's shooting over 55% from the floor. He's been awesome in a lot of games. He took 19 shots. I don't think that this was like a, oh, Indiana just funneled it into SGA and they kept Jalen Williams from going off. I think Jalen Williams is going to have some big games the way that one was played. Chet's the one I'm kind of curious about because I guess I didn't notice too much during the game, but I do wonder, did Indiana do much to take him out of it, only getting 9 shots and not really getting a bunch of easy shots at the rim? All of his shots were pretty much contested last night. Does Indiana have a way that, yeah, Chet Holmgren is not going to be a big factor? And Isaiah Hartenstein, I don't know, maybe we should talk about them as kind of one, if the Thunder are going to play them separately and not play them together a whole lot. Is it sort of a either-or situation between those two? And maybe it's not Chet, it's Hartenstein, but whatever. Between those two, Indiana didn't give up very much easy to those two. So that's the spot I'm interested in, plus the conversation around, do the Thunder play both of them together? Are they comfortable playing a double big lineup against Indiana? That's the position I'm really curious to see how that plays out the rest of the series.
Well, let me ask you about Cason Wallace being put into the starting lineup, because that to me was the huge mistake by Mark Dagno. And, you know, on Twitter, Matt Moore called it too cute. And I think it really was. Like, Cason Wallace went 3-of-9, 6 points. He was a team low minus 13. Isaiah Hartenstein, the guy who he didn't want to play in that double big lineup, gave you 9-of-9 in 17 minutes. And the other piece of that equation is I think it changes the calculus for how Indiana has to defend against the Thunder. Like, you should want the matchup of Chet against Pascal Siakam. Right? Like, that's just 14 feet of arms and legs, you know, swimming around and slapping each other. Like, that's the matchup you want for Chet Holmgren. What you don't want for Chet Holmgren is having to go against Miles Turner, who is strong enough to cause him a problem. I want to make sure that Miles Turner has to go over and deal with Isaiah Hartenstein.
It's one of the fascinating things for this series is what they do with that lineup, because if you look at the Pacers during this postseason run, there was a couple of times in that Cleveland series where Kenny Atkinson didn't play Jared Allen and Evan Mobley as much together. There was an injury in there, but they kind of went away from their double bigs during that Indiana series. And then we saw the Mitchell Robinson minutes against the Pacers in the conference finals, and he had some moments with a ton of offensive rebounds, but I think he had the second worst net rating in that series for New York. The Pacers won the minutes when New York was trying to say, we're going to beat you up with Mitchell Robinson on the floor. And I would have guessed before game one, Oklahoma City would have said, we're going to win the minutes with Hartenstein and Chet Holmgren on the floor together. We're going to be better than you when that happens. But Richard Jefferson made the point in the first quarter last night on the broadcast. If you're the Pacers and you see that starting lineup, you sit back and say, they've already adjusted to us. Like, we've already won something because they're already making a change that ultimately benefited Indiana last night and maybe benefits them the rest of this series, is saying, hey, we're Oklahoma City. We had the best record in the league. We're the overwhelming favorites. but we're matching up to Indiana. We're going to play how Indiana wants to play, or a lineup that matches up to Indiana. That does seem like an, I know they won game one, but that does seem like a win for Indiana, despite not actually being a win in the series.
Let me give you one more crazy stat here that goes along with the Oklahoma City offense and whether or not you should be worried about them going forward. The Oklahoma City Thunder had 16 more shots than the Indiana Pacers in game number one. That is usually the Pacers' recipe for beating you. They're the team that wants to get out and run and put up more shots and play a faster pace than you. If that happens again, I believe the Thunder are going to win. If Indiana turns the ball over 24 times again, I think the Thunder are going to win. If the Indiana Pacers again have more free throws than, I should say, if the Thunder have more free throws than the Pacers, I think the Thunder are going to win. And Tyler, here we are looking at all of these numbers and saying Indiana with a 1-0 lead in the series. It remains confounding.
Oh, the greatest team. The pinnacle for me of like the best NBA playoffs or NBA finals it's LeBron James coming back from 3-1 against the 73-win Warriors. Like it's great. It's phenomenal. If the Pacers win this NBA title, especially if Halliburton hits another late game, last second winner tying shot, it might pass that in my mind as like the most entertaining, most like just pure enjoyment I've had watching some form of playoff basketball, because what they're doing is unbelievable. It's incredible that they've done this to all of the teams that they have played, and Halliburton keeps delivering these moments. And like I told you before game one, I enjoy that the guy talks trash, has weird or goofy stuff. Like, he's fun. I love Tyrese Halliburton, and this could be better than what I still think is the greatest finals I've ever seen, coming back from 3-1 against the 73-win team. This could be better, because I think the big thing is I'll probably remember every one of the shots from all four rounds, whereas if you ask me right now, who did the Cavaliers beat before they got to the Warriors, couldn't tell you off the top of my head. So this is great, and they might get crushed in the next four, and we're like, all right, the Thunder were awesome, and that was fun, but it was over for the Pacers. But I have enjoyed this, and I hope it keeps happening.
Okay. I'm going to preface this so that you don't try to twist it on me. We talked yesterday about the fact that Tyrese Halliburton is absolutely capable of having superstar-level games. However, if that shot does not fall for Tyrese Halliburton at the end of the game, we're instead not of having Dwayne Wade yelling superstar into a weird bookshelf in his room, we're talking about Tyrese Halliburton scoring 12 points in game one and wondering whether he's ready for the big stage, right? We're not talking about superstar Tyrese Halliburton. We're talking about the fact that he scored 12 points in game one. I think what we need to talk about with Tyrese Halliburton is not the leap or the ascension or the superstar or this or that. I think we need to talk about a very good player who is capable of superstar level games, who has the Robert Horry clutch gene, right? Because we are having a very, very different conversation about Tyrese Halliburton if that shot doesn't fall, because he previously had one basket in the fourth quarter, and that was about 5 minutes earlier. He scored two field goals in the fourth quarter, and granted, he didn't have to because the rest of his team was going crazy. Six different Pacers were in double figures. The high scorer on the Pacers last night was Pascal Siakam with 19 points in a game in which they beat Oklahoma City. Give Tyrese Halliburton the flowers he deserves for making that shot, but also realize we're one bounce on the rim away from talking about a 12-point game and whether or not he's really the guy that we thought he was.
As if one bounce on the rim isn't what he specializes in. Come on now.
I know. I'm aware.
I also enjoyed the Miles Turner banked in three last night. That was a fun one.
How about the Nembhard crossover step back three? Like, all of these tail outcomes. Amazing.
Coming up next here on ESPN Las Vegas, it's Candy's Chonies.
It's Bischoff's Briefs, brought to you by Paul Padilaw. It's not about the injury. It's about the recovery.
We aren't sure if they're clean, but we're going deep, deep inside Candy's Chonies. Let's see what he has in there for us.
Earlier this week, I was given a choice inside Candy's Shoney's, which is always nice to be given a choice.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
One was something to make me mad, which we did earlier in the week. But I was told that there was a Candy's Shoney's segment that was going to make Adam mad.
No. It's the segment because I'm mad.
Oh, I apologize for misunderstanding that. So you've kept this rage building up for like 48 hours since we last did this?
And isn't that what you would hope for Candy's Shoney's?
Yes.
Is that I am feeling pent up and ready to give you a great performance?
I am always ready for a great performance. Again,
exactly,
I'm horrible in Candy's Shoney's. I never put on a good show, but I'm excited.
Stop. You're being too harsh on yourself. I will say this is going to be challenging for you because you don't have Danny, who has proven to be quite the expert at navigating the labyrinth that is Candy's Shoney's.
We're going to miss Danny today. It's a tough one. He's okay. He's my Nemhard and Neesmith from my Halliburton.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not sure which one of those. I'm not sure who's who in that one. But all right. Inside Candy's Shoney's for Jess and for anyone who's not familiar for what we're doing here. Tyler is going to get some numbers from me. I'm going to try to lead him along to try to figure out what in the world I'm talking about from sports. As I mentioned earlier this week, there were two Candy's Shoney's. I gave Tyler a choice. He ended up coming up with the right answer, and it made him mad, and that was exactly what it was supposed to do. This is because I'm mad, and so I'm just going to be a little bit petty, a little bit vindictive. How about that?
I'm excited.
Okay. All right. Your first number is 62,792.
62,792. All right. College football game attendance.
Okay, I understand why you would go attendance. No, it is a football number. I'll give you the winning part of what you said there. Okay.
Okay.
62,792 is a number from football. All right. Your second number is 381. It is also from football.
381 sounds like Geno Smith's career game-high passing yards.
Okay. I believe you are in the right area to be going toward the NFL and potentially toward an NFL quarterback. 62,792, 381. Okay. Very good. Very good. You know what, Tyler? I would say that the way you're trending inside Candy's Shoney's is pleasing me right now.
Oh.
It's making me less mad.
Oh.
But don't worry. I'll save enough of that pent-up rage for later. Okay. Your next number is actually a year. It is 2016.
2016. Okay. That's not too long ago. I got nothing. I'm not piecing these together.
2016 is a very important year for solving this. It is referring to one person. In fact, it is referring to a person we have discussed this week. Okay. He doesn't know, folks. He doesn't know. 62,792, 381. I feel the rage building inside me again.
I hope so. Okay, hold on. 62,000. That seems like too many passing yards for Russell Wilson's career.
It is passing yards.
Okay.
It is passing yards. I'm still mad.
Okay.
I'm still mad. I'm still taking it out on you.
Okay. I'm glad you are.
Don't you feel me taking it out on you?
Who did the Giants miss out on that had a bunch of passing yards?
Nope. In fact, the last time this person played in the NFL was 2022.
Okay. Oh, boy. Oh, God. All right. Is it Matt Ryan?
Oh, I thought you just figured it out there.
Is it Matt Ryan?
Like you got it.
Is it Matt Ryan?
These are the passing stats for Matt Ryan, who Tyler earlier this week suggested that potentially the Steelers should trade for. The problem with that is that Matt Ryan was 37 when he last played in 2022, and Tyler thought that Matt Ryan was Kirk Cousins.
Yeah, I made those the same person because my brain just went Atlanta Falcons quarterback, and that is Matt Ryan. Not Kirk Cousins.
Yeah, even though he played his last season in Indianapolis, that's exactly where your brain went. I just said, yeah, that's just me being a little bit vindictive and bringing something back. Can I tell you something also, quite honestly? I had read the Matt Ryan thing in the rundown. And I thought maybe it was just a copy paste thing. So I thought, I'm not going to say anything. And then you said it on the air, and I thought, oh, he really does think Matt Ryan is still in the league.
It was definitely not a copy-paste thing. It was a, because I can't remember who it was, Gary Dulac had the report that if the Steelers didn't get Rodgers, they'd go after another veteran quarterback. And my brain was like, well, the Falcons have one that's not going to start for him, and I just wrote in Matt Ryan.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Yep. By the way, the numbers to break that down, 62,792 career passing yards, 381 career touchdowns. His MVP season was in 2016. His last season was in 2022. If we had gone any farther with this, the last numbers you were going to get were 28-3.
Oh, okay. Oh, wait. Was it true? All right. You can make fun of me for paying attention to graphs about baseball on vacation, but I only vaguely saw this. Did the Atlanta Falcons post a picture from OTAs of two of their players and their jersey numbers were 28-3 standing next to each other?
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
And then they had to go back and delete it because people were like, yo, what are you doing?
Okay, I am just going to type in Falcons 28-3 photo and see what we come up with here.
Because I just love the idea that since that happened, I'm sure whoever runs social media accounts for the Falcons job has turned over like three times. Yep. I love the idea that somebody that, you know, was in ninth grade when that game happened, and by the way, into the future, somebody who wasn't born is going to have to like have this rule. Don't make any references to 28-3. Check every photo to make sure there's not some hidden 28-3 reference in there for the Atlanta Falcons.
I am screenshotting this and sending it to you right now so you can see. I cannot believe I missed this. Yes, they had two players with at least the order was 3 and then 28, which would make me feel a little bit better, but I guess that's how it looked on the Fox score bug with 2 minutes left in the third quarter. Oh, my God. Look, the Knicks blew an unbelievable game in game one of the Eastern Conference Finals, but it's got nothing on what the Falcons pulled off.
No, 28-3 is probably as bad as it's going to be forever. I mean, the Warriors blowing the 3-1 lead when they were a 73-win team is pretty bad. The fact that they sandwiched it with like seven more titles kind of makes you be like, oh, okay, that was a great LeBron accomplishment, not really a huge choke job there. If the Falcons had like won a Super Bowl after or maybe right before, maybe wouldn't sting as much. But the fact that the Falcons haven't, and are they going to anytime soon? Yeah, 28-3 is going to be about as bad as... I think we're probably going to need team blows 3-0 lead in the World Series or the NBA Finals to top that.
Well, when it happens, the first person we'll call for comment is Matt Ryan, who is not Kirk Cousins.
Coming up next, we'll get back into the NFL with Mike DeFabo covering the Steelers.
This has been Bischoff's Briefs, brought to you by Paul Pata Law. It's not about the injury, it's about the recovery.
40 seconds to go, first half. Fake it. Fields. Running for the touchdown. Fields takes it in for the score. Pittsburgh goes in front.
You're listening to the Press Box on 100.9 FM and 1100 AM.
Joining us now, covering the Steelers for The Athletic, it's Mike DeFabo. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So I want to ask you, if you gave the Steelers the knowledge that they would sign Aaron Rodgers, but it would take until early June, would they still have made him like the top option at the beginning of the offseason, or would they have said, we don't like that, we're going to go after somebody else like Sam Darnold or something?
Well, I think that they were comfortable with this process. And one thing you should know about Mike Tomlin, he may be one of the best players' coaches in terms of understanding personal situations. And so Aaron Rodgers throughout this process said that the reason it took so long is because he was dealing with the personal circumstance. And, you know, I wrote a story at The Athletic a couple years ago. We talked to like 25 different players. And guys would come to him for a variety of reasons and say, look, I've got something going on in my personal life. Guys said, you know, their wife had a miscarriage or they had a death in the family. And Mike Tomlin never asked what's going on. He just said, go be with your family, do what you need to do. And so in some ways it did make sense that the Steelers were willing to be more patient. The other part of it is, as the dominoes started falling early in free agency, really the Steelers wanted Justin Fields. That was their hope. But for whatever reason, that didn't materialize, whether they got outbid or whether him being benched amid a 4-2 start to the season left a sour taste in his mouth. After that, Sam Darnold was discussed by the Steelers. He came off the board very quickly. And at that point, the options were so limited and that they were comfortable waiting, believing that, like, if they had to go with Mason Rudolph, they were going to do it. But there was no incentive really to like make a line in the sand because of the fact they believed Aaron was going to come here.
Mike, if that's what they wanted as the outcome to have Justin Fields back, why do you think they handled last season the way they did?
Well, I think that they didn't know what they wanted at first. And
okay.
Here's the thing that I think is a good parallel is, the Steelers have for a couple years believed that they had a championship caliber defense. They're for the fourth consecutive year going to have the NFL's highest paid defense. And I think Mike Tomlin and a lot of members of the organization are looking to give Cameron Hayward the elusive championship trophy. And they believe that Russell Wilson, because he had been there, done that, he could take this team and elevate them. And their thought process was, Russell Wilson might not be what he once was, but we don't need him to be with this defense. And my criticism of this move here is it feels like they're basically trying to run back that same playbook and say, we know that at 41 years old, Aaron Rodgers is not going to be competing at MVP caliber level. But we think because we have the support system and the defense, we don't need him to. But I've just seen this story play out too many times that until I see it on the field, I am going to be reasonably skeptical of how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, I want to read everybody a great passage from your article at The Athletic that you wrote about this. You said, this is the problem with aging quarterbacks. It's not as if the Monstars from Space Jam sneak into their houses while they're sleeping and steal their powers overnight. Instead, it's much more subtle, deceiving to the eye and the emotions. Often the flashes of brilliance are still in there, are still there in doses, reminders of what once was. And I think this is my favorite line, but nostalgia is a dangerous drug. It's been a while since we saw Aaron Rodgers play well, Mike. Do you think that there's anything about what the Steelers have, whether it's DK Metcalf, whether it's Arthur Smith's offense, etc., that can elevate what is left of Aaron Rodgers?
Well, you know, I give Arthur Smith credit because there may not be two more different quarterbacks than last year with Justin Fields and Russell Wilson. And so he was able to take both of those guys that the league had considerable doubts about. Like Justin Fields was available for just a sixth-round pick. They were giving him away for free, essentially. Russell Wilson, the Denver Broncos paid him to go away. And both of those guys are in a better position after working with Arthur Smith. Now, the challenge for them is going to be, stylistically, this doesn't really seem like a great fit. Arthur Smith ran the football fourth most in the NFL last year, and he likes a lot of motion within his offense. And on the flip side, Aaron Rodgers threw the ball second most out of any quarterback last year, and he wants a precise passing game. And so that's going to be the challenge, is like, what's going to be the identity of this team? When they hired Arthur Smith, they wanted to be this run-heavy, old-school, ground-and-pound Pittsburgh Steelers offense, but does that fit what Aaron Rodgers does? And so the other thing that's going to be interesting about that relationship is Russell Wilson and Arthur Smith had some friction at the end of the year because of some differences of opinion on changing plays at the line of scrimmage. And we know that Aaron Rodgers has a very complicated set of hand signals, and he's all about that. He wants to be the conductor and the commander when he's behind center. So will he be permitted to have that freedom, and does that fit his skill set at this stage, or is he willing to, you know, in some senses, swallow his pride or his ego to a degree and say, I'm willing to be a bit of a more conservative passer and play into this run-heavy type of offense.
Do you still think this is a playoff team? Do you think they're a 9 or 10-win team that finds a way in the postseason?
I think that they are about there, but I don't think that they've elevated their ceiling. And that's a frustration for Steelers fans because Steelers fans get told repeatedly, you don't know how good you have it. You should be lucky and fortunate, you know. And people say, Mike Tomlin's never had a losing season. Well, that's meant as a compliment from the national media, and it's become a bit of a tongue-in-cheek jab here in Pittsburgh because of the fact that, like, it's been eight seasons and they haven't won a playoff game. And so, you know, I think that if Mike Tomlin can get Duck Hodges nearly to the playoffs and preserve his non-losing season streak, he certainly should be able to win about 9-10 games. But I don't know that Aaron Rodgers at this stage and in this version is going to push you over the top and in a very competitive quarterback-driven AFC, stand toe-to-toe with Joe Burrow, stand toe-to-toe with Patrick Mahomes, stand toe-to-toe with Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen. And so maybe he'll surprise me. But I think what we're going to get is a mixed bag from Aaron Rodgers, where you're going to see some games where you're going to say, that looks like the old Aaron Rodgers. And then you're going to see some games that say, that looks like a 41-year-old guy trying to play quarterback. And I think most of it's going to be somewhere in between and probably finish a game or two above 500. And if I had to guess, probably not win that playoff game that's been eluding them for a while.
Mike DeVito from The Athletic joining us here in the press box with Tyler and Adam. You mentioned the Tomlin losing streak stat there. Do you think there is any way in which, with Mike Tomlin as head coach, this team would be able to enter a true rebuild phase? Like, they would be willing to have a 3 or 4 win season to get a franchise quarterback and build from the bottom?
I don't think so. I just don't think it's in Mike Tomlin's DNA. You see him at the Senior Bowl going up to players that aren't even going to play for him and challenging them. I want you to go head to head against this guy. You know, you see him standing next to the punter during training camp and saying, like, all right, this is a big one now, and trying to put the pressure on him. This man lives and thrives on competition, and I just don't think it's in him to do that. The other part is, again, like, I think that he's very much motivated at this stage of his career to try to get Cam Hayward a Super Bowl, to try to get T.J. Watt a Super Bowl, to try to get Minka Fitzpatrick a playoff win. And so I think that this defense came together right at the very end of Ben Roethlisberger's tenure. When they traded for Minka in 2019, really they had completed this defense that they had been working more than a decade to build. And it's interesting in some ways because it gave Ben one last chance to go for it. Now that defense itself is risking aging out without accomplishing much of anything. Like, it's startling that T.J. Watt has never won a playoff game in his career, and he's up for his third contract. It's startling that Cam Hayward has built a Hall of Fame legacy, and he has been healthy and in uniform for one playoff win. So those are things that drive Mike Tomlin, and I just don't think that they would be willing to say, we're rebuilding, we're tanking this year because we need a long-term solution, even though they do. Going with the stopgap solution, they need some stability there.
I believe it was Ian Rappaport that reported this morning the Steelers have inquired about trading for Kyle Pitts from Atlanta. What would you make of that acquisition if they landed Kyle Pitts?
Well, it makes sense because Arthur Smith likes guys who used to play for him, and he loves tight ends. The Steelers led the league last year in 13 personnel usage with one running back, three tight ends. And I think it's about 45% of their plays, they have at least two tight ends on the field at the same time. So tight end makes a lot of sense. You know, Jonnu Smith is another guy that name has been tossed around a lot and also fits all those same criteria. And I think that the key is they need some other receiving threat. Like, they went out and they got DK Metcalf, and that was a huge splash. But then they turned around and dealt George Pickens because they were kind of sick of his immaturities. And so now, like, last year, their season went into a tailspin when George Pickens got hurt because they basically had one legitimate wide receiver, a huge gap, and then a lot of other question marks. And so, you know, there is at least a bit of a hope within the Steelers organization. Like, if we're going to get a guy like Aaron Rodgers, we need to at least kind of go for it here and surround him with enough weapons to try to do as much as he can. So, you know, I think that it's kind of funny, like, you guys are in Vegas, and I always get these odds sent to me. The Steelers are always the favorite for every single player who's out there. And with Omar Khan, Wheeler, and Dealer, they're probably going to continue to be. So any tight end, any wide receiver that you can think of that's available, you're going to see the Steelers' name on that list of odds.
Well, he is Mike DeFabo. Well, oh, go ahead, Adam. Go ahead.
No, I am all set because I think that's a perfect way to end this.
Well, he is Mike DeFabo from The Athletic covering the Steelers. Mike, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Mike DeFabo on the Steelers, who now have Aaron Rodgers as their quarterback and could have Kyle Pitts to play tight end in the very near future. But now, we've got some tickets to give away. If you want to go see Ron White, now's your chance. Ron White is coming to Vegas on June 21st. He's going to be at the Chelsea Theater at the Venetian. There are tickets available at Ticketmaster.com, but we've got a pair to give away right now. 702-364-1100. That is the phone number. Again, it's comedian Ron White. It's two tickets. He's at the Chelsea Theater at the Venetian on Saturday, June 21st. 702-364-1100. That's the phone number if you want to go see Ron White. Call in now at 702-364-1100. Caller number 8 at 702-364-1100.
You're on the elevator up to the press box with Graney and Bischoff.
Adam Candy in this week for Ed, as Ed is at his son's wedding. Adam will be back on Monday. There's one last thing we need to do from game one of the NBA Finals that I said during the playoffs I wanted to do as much as possible because I don't feel like enough people do this. We do it in the NFL, but not in the NBA. We had two challenges last night. Both coaches lost their only challenge last night, and I think they were both very different challenges. Mark Dagenau of the Thunder challenged a foul call on Isaiah Hartenstein in the third quarter. It was Hartenstein's second foul of the game, so there was no, like, uh-oh, he's getting into foul trouble situation here. And he lost the challenge because Hartenstein actually did foul Benedict Mathurin on the wrist. I think this was a case of a coach being influenced by the player, being adamant that I didn't foul him, you should challenge that, and giving into that when it was very clear on the replay that he did foul Benedict Mathurin. Had Oklahoma City won the challenge, they would have taken two free throws away from Indiana, and instead it would have probably been Oklahoma City basketball, as that came off of Mathurin's hand last. But I think that is a clear bad challenge by Mark Dagenau, where he's challenging something and there is not nearly enough benefit to challenge something in the third quarter.
Tyler, short of the last 5 minutes of a game, what are the good reasons to challenge in basketball? Number of fouls, right? Like, if it's someone's fourth or fifth foul early in the game, and that's a key player, maybe there's that. I struggle to come up with other reasons. Do you have other ones?
I don't think so. I really don't. I think it's really are you going to have your, and honestly, like, your best player, maybe your second best player. I don't even think it'd be worth it for Hartenstein. Like, if that had been Hartenstein's fifth foul in the third quarter, I don't think it's worth it then. Like, if it's SGA's fifth, okay. And I do think you need, like, the, hey, yeah, we're going to win this from your bench. Your thumbs up saying, yep, we've looked at this. We feel really good about winning this, even if it is SGA's fifth foul. Because what we saw last night was a good example of it. Indiana didn't challenge anything the entire game until the final 30 seconds there, even though every time Aaron Nesmith loses the ball and it's given to the other team, he thinks it went off of the other team. They didn't challenge anything, but with 22 seconds left, Rick Carlisle used his first challenge. Now, he lost the challenge. Indiana did not win this challenge. They did not get a benefit from this, but the situation made it worthwhile because Indiana's down one. The call on the floor was the ball went out of bounds off of Pascal Siakam. It did, but the challenge was to see if there was a foul. Did he get pushed? There was some contact, but the refs deemed not enough for there to be an actual foul, which I think was probably the right call. But the reason I think that challenge was good or smart or at least significantly better than Dagenau's is that the moment there, if Indiana wins that challenge, they get the ball back with 22 and a half seconds left, down one. Losing the challenge or not challenging at all gave Oklahoma City the ball with 22 and a half seconds left, up one. Now, SGA missed the shot and Indiana went on to win it anyways, but that was a big moment that was worth challenging, even if their chances to win were less than 50%. It's all about the moment and the win probability at that moment. And it just doesn't exist until you get late into games. And Carlisle's had some bad challenges in this playoffs, but I think we've now seen twice where he has done a good job not listening to any of the complaints from his players or maybe even the bench. And then we get to those final minutes and he has a high value moment that he challenges and gives his team a chance to get a possession back or take points off the board.
Well, you don't have to go any farther than game one against the Knicks.
Right.
The challenge that he used on a Pascal Siakam foul, which I still think was questionable that they overturned the call, but he used it at the perfect time. Because if that foul stands against Pascal Siakam, the Pacers don't win that game. The comeback falls short. So that's exactly when you need to use it. But Tyler, I'm going to tell you a story from when I've been refereeing that I think explains why you need to reframe how you explain this to coaches. You need to reframe it from, this is why you don't use the challenge here, to what happens if you don't have the challenge here. I had a play, remember, I think it was in the third quarter. It was an out-of-bounds play right near this team's bench. And the ball goes out. I call it for the team that is not the team right there on the bench. And the coach goes nuts. He puts his hands in the air. He's coming down the sideline. He's starting to yell. And he's a coach that I knew. And I looked at him and I said, hey, save it for when it matters. And you could see him just stop for a second and think to himself. And he just kind of nodded and he walked away. Right? Because I had explained to him, like, listen, there's going to come a time when you really need to come after me to try to earn some outcome that you think you're going to get. But it's not this call right here. We need to explain this to coaches by saying, what's going to happen when you don't have a challenge with 30 seconds left?
Which is almost, could have happened to the Pacers last time. Again, they lost that challenge, but in theory, they could have won that, gotten possession, and would have been a big deal. But Carlisle burned a challenge on a second quarter TJ McConnell foul or something like that, and you don't have it to try to win that. I also like the implication there of your story, because all I heard was you told a coach, hey, save it for when I blow a call later in the game.
Sure, you can hear it that way, because I probably will. But seriously, like, I wanted to explain to him, as someone who I knew was generally a coach who could be reasonable, like, I knew he was just caught up in the emotion of the moment. And he's got all of his kids sitting right next to him saying, no, 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 no. You can't challenge on emotion, ever. And NBA coaches have a lot more resources at their advantage. They've got guys sitting back there with the iPad figuring out, do we challenge this, very quickly. But the fact of the matter is, in most cases, that guy with the iPad shouldn't even be there until later in the game. Don't even give the coach the option to get a thumbs up from the 17th assistant coach that they should challenge this one.
He doesn't even get a seat on a bench until there's 5 minutes left.
Yeah, like, he should get to walk out like wrestling style in the last 5 minutes of the game. Like, oh, he's here.
One of the big things, now that we basically have challenges in all of our major sports, that sticks out to me is that hockey coaches have gotten bailed out, because we see it in football, we see it in basketball, baseball coaches or managers, not too bad, but we see bad challenges all the time on coaches challenging things they should not be challenging. Hockey coaches got bailed out because you can only challenge goals. You can only challenge the most important thing that happens in a game. Should this goal count or not? There's never a dumb challenge for did the puck go out of play.